TED Audio Collective.
Got a business problem? There's a TED Talk for that. Stay updated on everything business on TED Business, a podcast hosted by Columbia Business School professor Modupe Akinola. Every week, she'll introduce you to leaders with unique insights on work, answering questions like, how do four-day work weeks work? Will a machine ever take my job? Get some surprising answers on TED Business, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, work-lifers. We're working hard on Season 5, exploring the great resignation, flexibility at work, overcoming perfectionism, and a lot more. And one of the episodes will be all about you. Since work life is about making work not suck, we want to know what ideas from the show have helped you change your job, your team, or your organization. What worked? What didn't? And how did you take work life into your work life? Let us know at our hotline at 561-926-5107. That's 561-926-5107. Or you can email a voice note to worklife@ted.com. That's worklife@ted.com. In the meantime, here's a conversation I had on the Next Big Idea podcast. It's with science journalist extraordinaire Annie Murphy-Paul, who challenged my deep-seated belief that we do our best thinking inside our brains. If you like it, you can hear more episodes of The Next Big Idea wherever you're listening. Hey, Annie Murphy-Paul. It's great to see you.
Hi, Adam. It's great to see you, too.
It's been a long time.
It has.
Were you just hiding away writing this book since I last saw you?
Pretty much. But then, you know, that's the life of a book author, is that you hide away for a long time and then it's like out in the world. So since the book came out in June, I feel like I've been overexposed.
So you're overdue to crawl back into your cave.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it.
Well, I'm not going to let you there yet, in part because this is just an extraordinary accomplishment. I think it's such an important and fascinating book. And I have to tell you that I was a little bit annoyed at the idea of the book, because for a long time, whenever somebody says, you know, trust your gut, my instinctive response, my reflex almost, has been, you know, I actually prefer to do my thinking with my brain. Good luck with that gut thing. And your book made me rethink that maybe all of my thinking is not done in my head. So I guess my just table stakes question for you is, am I one of these people who's still stuck in a world where every body part has a specific function, including the brain?
Well, I hear you there, Adam, because I think of myself as being, or as formerly being, kind of brain-bound myself. Brain-bound is this word that I use a lot in the book that I borrowed from the philosopher Andy Clark, and he uses it to mean that we assume that thinking goes on in the brain and we leave out all these other extra neural resources like the body and physical space and other people. When we think about thinking, we think about it happening in our brain. And I am someone who very much lives in my head. So in a way, the journey of writing this book for me was kind of a process of convincing myself. So if it convinces other people, you know, readers, that's wonderful. It was a journey that I had to take myself.
Okay, so I'm glad I'm not the only one whose assumptions were challenged by the premise of this book. Tell me, what first sparked the idea or the question?
Yeah, so I had gotten very interested in writing about the science of learning. I have two kids who, you know, are in school. They're now in middle school and high school. But when they started school, that was really when my interest in the science of learning took root. And for both personal and then professional reasons, for personal reasons, because I was seeing my kids learning, I was seeing my kids' teachers teach them, and that was all very interesting to me. But then as a science writer, I couldn't help but notice that there was all this exciting, provocative, dynamic research coming out in the learning sciences. So those two things kind of came together. And then from there, what I needed was a big idea that would pull together all these strands of research that I was finding so interesting, you know, on embodied cognition and situated cognition and socially distributed cognition. And it wasn't until I read this article by two philosophers, Andy Clark and David Chalmers, that had come out years before in 1998 called The Extended Mind, that I felt something click and I felt like, oh, this is the idea that could kind of pull it all together. This idea that thinking doesn't only happen in the brain and challenge that very pervasive and common idea that thinking all goes on up here.
I think this idea that thinking doesn't just happen in the brain, I guess in some ways it challenges my very sense of what a person is, right? I've thought for a long time that whenever somebody says, well, in the future, we'll be able to upload our brains. I'm like, but uploading the contents of my brain doesn't upload my mind. All I want is my consciousness. And that could be in any body. It could be in any place. And I'm going to be the same. And one of the things your book led me to wonder is, am I wrong about that?
That's interesting. I think we do identify with ourselves with our brains often. You know, it's like where we feel like we're located. But I actually, in the course of researching and writing this book, I came to think that I could more fully inhabit myself by acknowledging and embracing the fact that I'm also a body. I'm also embedded in in physical surroundings. I'm also part of a network of social connections. And that to me is actually a fuller idea of what a person is than just a brain that can, as you say, be uploaded. And that's the essence of who you are. I've come to really question that.
So tell me, what is it that extends the mind? You write a lot about embodied cognition, which, you know, I think one of the things that really caught me off guard about this book is you synthesize a lot of research that I'd read and I'd kind of missed the punchline of it. Like, I didn't see the big idea. I was like, oh yeah, you know, it's cute that when, you know, you put a pen in your, you know, in your lips, and you don't smile, you don't sometimes feel as happy as if you put a pen in your teeth and you smile. But I don't think I understood the larger lesson of that whole body of embodied cognition research. So talk to me a little bit about how embodied cognition works and what it means about what makes our minds work.
Sure. First, I'm kind of curious about what you think the punchline is. I wonder if I'm getting it.
Well, I think the punchline is this larger realization about the extended mind, right? So I thought embodied cognition research was mostly about the ways in which often unexpected and invisible situational forces could alter the way that we think and feel. And I think you're making a much grander and more exciting point, which is, no, the very thinking we do depends on the way we move.
Yes. And that is a big idea that took a while for me to wrap my head around, that because we approach thinking in this brain-centric manner, neurocentric manner, we sort of imagine that the brain is this command center and everything starts here and we direct the body to do things. The brain directs the body to do things. And so it was so interesting to think about reversing that causal arrow and realizing that by moving the body in certain ways, moving the hands, moving the full body and physical activity could affect the way the brain operates. Now, of course, the brain is still directing the body to do things, but
I'm glad you said that. Like, wait a minute, this is circular. Yeah.
Yes, but it's kind of a way of indirectly influencing how we're thinking by getting the body moving, which is not, again, it's not this top-down process that we're so used to thinking about. And I'll give you an example. You know, there's this amazing research on fidgeting and how fidgeting, which is something that as a culture we tend to look down on and disparage, I think in part because of that very old and entrenched belief that mind and body are separate and mind is superior and body is unruly and irrational. Research that I love by Catherine Isbister, who's a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who looks at the ways that fidgeting can affect different kinds of fidget objects, different kinds of fidget movements can induce different kinds of mental states. And so she calls this embodied self-regulation. And, you know, there's so much emphasis on self-regulation and self-regulation skills in schools and in academia. And it's so interesting to me that we think of that as a resource that we muster from within, you know, and the idea that it could flow the other way, that we could actually regulate ourselves by moving our bodies. To me, that's like just a really fresh and interesting way of new way of thinking about how thinking can be enhanced.
So what does fidgeting do? And what should I say to my karate sensei who told me as an 8-year-old that I needed to stop fidgeting?
Oh, really? Huh. Well, if you can still find him, you might tell him that fidgeting can be a really adaptive activity, like a really fine-grained way of modulating our arousal, our alertness level. And depending on what kinds of fidget movements we're engaging in and what kind of fidget objects we're employing, it can soothe us if we're feeling anxious, or it can be sort of playful and open our minds and make us more open to new ideas, or it can just sort of elevate our mood in a way that, you know, Catherine Isbister notes that we usually spend almost all our time at work or often at school with these really sleek, you know, I'm looking at my laptop here, very sleek, hard, shiny surfaces of our devices. And she thinks that fidget objects, which, you know, she's collected this whole gallery of images of fidget objects that people have sent her. And she has a Tumblr account devoted to that. And interestingly, a lot of these objects are like, they're very tactile. They're very, a lot of them are natural materials or like stones or sticks or something. And she thinks that fidgeting with these objects sort of reminds us that we are human, that we are embodied, that we do have all these senses that get left out when we're just sort of a brain in front of a screen.
Wait, are you about to sell me a fidget spinner? I feel like this is the perfect setup for, and by the way, there's more.
Yes.
Okay, so another example of extending the mind with the body is the research you write about on interoception. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. And there's something about this research that is a little unsettling to me. And I want to see if we could unpack it a little bit. But first, tell me what you learned about interoception. What is it and what are the consequences?
Sure. I hope reading my book was an enjoyable experience for you.
I loved it.
I feel like maybe it was a little distressing.
I loved it. I was such an enthusiastic champion of this book. But as you well know, letting go of beliefs you've held strongly can be, for me, it was a combination of exhilarating and, you know, like mildly distressing. Like, wait a minute. If that's not true, what about all these other beliefs that went with it?
Yeah. And I think you wrote a whole book about that. Think again.
But, I may need to rethink that.
Interoception, you know, that was not a word that I knew before I started this research. Although, like everyone else, I know the phrase gut feelings, as you referenced earlier, or intuition. And I too was skeptical of those ideas. Honestly, I am again, like a very brain bound kind of person who relies on my intellect to make decisions. And so the idea that the body and its sensations might have something, some kind of knowledge to share with us or some kind of wisdom I was skeptical of that. But when I understood after reading the research, the mechanism by which that happens, I became a lot more open to the idea. And that is that, you know, as we go through our daily lives, there's so much information we're taking in, far too much information to process or be aware of all that consciously. But it is stored on a non-conscious level. And then, you know, the question is, well, how do we have access to that, those patterns and those regularities if it's not conscious? And the answer is that that's where these bodily cues come in. You know, what Antonio Damasio calls somatic markers. It's like the body is tapping us on the shoulder or giving us a tug on the sleeve to say like, hey, you've seen this before, or this is a situation that you should pay attention to. And if you're not attuned to those internal signals and cues, then you're missing out on this kind of wealth of information that you yourself have collected and possess, but don't have access to unless you're sensitive to those internal sensations.
I thought a particularly striking data point on that was people on Wall Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
Small sample, but tell us.
Yes. That's an intriguing study an interesting one for sure, just to sort of bat around and think about. And I think it is interesting because I at least think of finance as kind of a brain-centric occupation where you're crunching lots of numbers and, you know, big brains kind of rule the day. But what this study found was that traders, financial traders on a London trading floor, those traders had a keener sense of interoception than a control group of people kind of off the street. And also within the group of traders, those who were more interoceptively attuned, and the way that that was measured was how sensitive they were to their own heartbeats. And the more interoceptively attuned they were, the more profitable their trades and the longer they hung on in this sort of notoriously volatile profession. So I thought it was so interesting that, like, we pay so much attention to intellectual kinds of credentials, like where somebody went to school or what their test scores were, you know, but it turned out, and I imagine those things played a role in the hiring of these financial traders. But all the while, there was this other factor, you know, how attuned were they to their internal sensations that no one was measuring or even thinking about. And yet it may well play a role in how well they do their jobs.
This is, for me, the unsettling part is... Mm-hmm. I guess there's a part of me that worries that if people understand, you know, at least some of the science on the power of interoception, that they start to over-rely on their gut feelings. And what concerns me is that sometimes your bodily sensations are sending you the wrong signal.
True.
Or you misinterpret it. And I guess what I was wondering about is, how do you make sure that people don't just take this as scientific justification for always trusting their gut?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I would say, first of all, that I don't think the answer would be suppressing internal sensations or bodily sensations entirely. Like, that doesn't seem to lead to effective decision making either. I mean, again, Antonio Damasio has these fascinating case studies of patients who that part of the brain that monitors feelings and sensations is in some way disabled, and they're not able to make effective decisions because none of their choices are tagged for them with, you know, with a sense of meaning or an affective valence. So they're not good at making decisions at all. But you're absolutely right that there are times when our internal sensations are going to be guiding us wrong. And so, you know, one measure that I recommend in the book is keeping what I call an interoceptive journal, which would involve sort of noting what your internal sensations are as you debate various choices, and then seeing how each one makes you feel and keeping a record of how that decision turned out so that you can begin to engage in a process of learning when your internal sensations are guiding you reliably and when they may be steering you wrong.
So as we think about the different ways that our movement affects our cognition, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about gesturing. I was riveted by some of the research that you covered, suggesting that we literally talk with our hands.
Yeah.
But sometimes our hands actually lead us into our thoughts, which was a much more novel idea than I'd ever had about, you know, just the illustrative or the elaborative effects of hand movements. The idea that I could move and actually learn or verbalize through my motions, that was a completely fresh perspective for me. So how did you arrive at that, and what do we know?
Yeah, I loved the gesture research too, because we so often, I mean, we gesture all the time, right? I'm gesturing right now, but we don't think about what our hands are doing. And if we do, we kind of imagine that it's a follow along to what we're saying, you know, or that it's principally about communicating to other people. But what was so interesting to me about this gesture research was that actually our gestures are helping our own thinking. And that far from being a kind of clumsy, you know, tag along to our verbal speech, because we're very, you know, focused on verbal language in our culture and less so on what our bodies are doing. But in this case, often our gestures are leading the way, that our most advanced, our newest, our most cutting edge ideas often show up first in our gestures. And then by kind of looking at our own self-created information source, you know, of our hands, we can kind of read off of that, and that informs our emerging verbal explanation. And I write about these really interesting studies that show in action this phenomenon that scientists call gestural foreshadowing. So, like, before a few seconds before milliseconds before we put words to what we're saying, our gestures are already there and are already beginning to convey what we're about to say. And what's interesting is that once you know that, you can see that happening, people beginning to try to express something and it shows up first in their hands and then their words actually are trailing along behind.
What do you do with that information? Have you found yourself deliberately incorporating more gestures to try to improve the flow of your creative thinking, for example? Or is this just something that's intrinsically interesting but doesn't necessarily have immediate practical applications in a world that hasn't given us the technology to use our gestures effectively?
Yeah. Well, I do find it intrinsically interesting, but I also think it has some practical applications. Like I have two kids and I encourage them to gesture. You know, again, just like fidgeting, our culture has this bias against bodily movement. And so we tend to sometimes disparage gesture as, you know, hand waving, or it's sort of gauche to be moving your hands around too much. And so I feel liberated by this research to gesture a lot myself. And I encourage my kids to gesture when they're trying to explain or describe something. I'll say, you know, try moving your hands when you say that. And then I also do some teaching, and I haven't yet had a chance to apply this, but I love the idea of creating occasions for gesture. You know, like people are more likely to gesture when they have to give an impromptu explanation in front of a group, because that's really cognitively taxing. And so we tend to offload some of that burden onto our hands. And you want that. You want to get people gesturing as much as possible. And also people tend to gesture more when there's something to gesture at, you know, like a model or a diagram or a chart. So the next time I teach a class, I really want to find ways to incorporate gesture into my own teaching, which it's been found that that actually helps people speak more fluently and express their ideas more coherently when they gesture a lot, but then also find ways to encourage students to gesture. And I also, one more thing that I do now is I do try to put my camera when I'm on Zoom far enough away so that my hands are visible in the screen, so that we're not just like talking heads, because so much of what we convey to each other is conveyed through gesture.
Which also has a, I guess, ancillary benefit for reducing Zoom fatigue. I don't mm-hmm. know if you've seen Jeremy Bailenson's recent work showing that one of the reasons so many people are exhausted by video conferences is we literally sit too close to the screen, which makes it harder to process all the cues that other people are sending. And sometimes we flinch when we see a large virtual head. Mm-hmm. And that if you back up, not only do you get the benefits of showing your own hand gestures, but it's also more like the way that you would look at someone else when you're sitting in a meeting with them.
Yes. Oh, that's so interesting. I wonder if that could be an unforeseen benefit of something we all hate about Zoom, which is looking at ourselves on Zoom. You know, if we're seeing our own gestures from that third person perspective, I wonder if that is actually kind of informative.
Oh, I don't know. The self-view is another predictor of Zoom fatigue. Right? Yeah, so I think the self-consciousness probably outweighs the learning value. But mm-hmm. I could see, you know, as somebody who's spent a fair amount of time trying to learn how to not look like a Muppet on stage, I could see value in, you know, in a dedicated practice environment, reviewing the video and saying, wow, I move like a Muppet on Zoom too. Let me work on some of these gestures. Huh.
I will say I like Muppets, so I have nothing against looking like a Muppet.
So we've been talking about body movements as ways to extend the mind. You cover a few other ways of essentially enhancing the functions of your brain that are outside of your mind. One of those is physical space.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about, you know, we've all seen the benefits of taking a walk, for example, or being in nature.
Right.
Talk about the psychology of why that matters, and then maybe some of the less well-known ways that we can extend our minds with the space around us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned taking walks outside. And I think that the effects of the nature and the outdoors is another kind of, I liken it to our, you know, the reaction we were talking about before about being a little skeptical of, like, you know, listen to your gut and your intuition. Like, of course, it's great to go outside and everyone loves nature and, you know, hug a tree and all that. That I was a little going into it, I was a little skeptical of that not that advice, but just kind of like the how profound or how interesting is that? And again, I found myself surprised by and interested by the mechanics of how that happens, why we do reliably experience this positive affect, positive feelings when we go outside, this sense of relaxation, the sense of being restored. And I was so interested to learn about the fact that, you know, because our brains evolved, human beings evolved in the outdoors, this life we live where we're inside houses or inside cars for like upwards of 90% of our day is a relatively recent development. And in fact, our perceptual faculties evolved to take in the kind of information that is so common in nature, you know, that is a diffuse kind of light and gentle movement and, you know, repeating patterns like birdsong or waves crashing on a beach. And all of those stimuli, we perceive them in a really effortless and easy to process kind of way. And so when we, as opposed to an urban setting with its sharp edges and fast moving objects and loud sounds and stuff, or even an interior space, which again is unlike nature in many ways. And then when we're in those interior spaces, we're often focusing very intently on, you know, little squiggles on a page or on a screen. And so when we go outside, we have an entirely different experience of having our attention diverted and drawn in various directions, but in a very low key and kind of relaxing way. And what's so interesting to me is that we spend so much time worrying about our attention, you know, where we direct our attention and whether our attention is focused or being distracted by all the many distractions that are available. So we think about the demand, all the demands on our attention, but we don't think about the supply. Like we don't think about like, how do we refill the tank of our attention? And it turns out that the best way to restore our attention, to refill our tank of attentional resources, so to speak, is to go outside and spend time in nature and just and leave your device behind.
I'm reminded of Stephen Rachel Kaplan's research on the reasonable person model, where they studied how exposure to nature literally makes people more reasonable. Mm-hmm. And allows them to maybe access some of their more civil and kind tendencies. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's a connection between that work and the point that you're making here, which is when our mind is constrained by the space around us, do we have fewer degrees of freedom to rethink a situation or to override what might be an instinctive angry or aggressive or, you know, or anxious response.
Mm. Yeah. And that reminds me of the research on the power of awe, you know, which is, and of course you can experience awe in a cathedral or in some other amazing human built setting, but so often we experience awe in nature. And what the experience of awe does for us is, you know, it acts as a reset button for the human brain, as one of the researchers that I quote in the book says, and it kind of shakes up our sense of what's possible and our schemas that so often define how we think and what we can think. And so it was hard for me not to compare the experience of like vast, majestic nature to the much more common experience we have of staring at our little screens. You know, do little screens make for little thoughts in a way, you know?
Wow. And of course, I can imagine some folks in Silicon Valley hearing that and immediately thinking, okay, I need to design a better virtual reality platform that creates that sense of awe and expansiveness.
And of course, I do recommend the big screen for other reasons, you know, in a section on a chapter on thinking with the space of ideas. Again, because when we treat ideas and information as kind of a landscape that we can navigate through, which again is how we evolve to interact with our environment. When we can navigate through a three-dimensional landscape in a sense of ideas and information, we can make use of all those embodied resources that come so naturally to the human animal, but that get wasted when all our thoughts stay inside our heads.
Let's go to another way that you talk about extending our minds, which is through social interaction, mm-hmm. our engagement with other people. I remember in grad school, I had a mentor who said, I'm going to have a very productive week ahead. because I have nothing on my calendar and I'm going to sit and think.
Not talk to anybody.
Yeah. And I thought that was such a limited way to access knowledge. And I think it reflects a common assumption in Western culture that deep thought happens alone.
Yes. Yes.
You are not convinced.
No. And again, you know, this is something I had to learn for myself because I've been a freelance writer for 20 something years and a lot of my work is very solitary, but I did become convinced by the research that I reviewed for this book that the way that, as you mentioned, Western culture separates social life from intellectual or academic life and treats them not only as separate, but in some ways opposed is really mistaken. You know, I think about the way that the school day is set up for so many of our kids that like, okay, you can be social on the playground or at lunchtime, but when you come into the classroom, you put all that aside and you just use your brain. And the reason that's so foolish is that we're such deeply fundamentally social creatures and we're social all the time. And our social brains are so powerful that really we should be finding ways to harness and leverage that social nature in the service of learning or in the service of our work. You know, I write in the book about some ways we can do that, social activities like storytelling and arguing with each other and teaching other people, all of which, you know, you can imagine how those things could be incorporated into learning and teaching. And many teachers are already doing that.
Okay, Annie, so I wonder if you could reconcile this idea that social interaction extends our minds with the extensive evidence that group brainstorming is less productive and less creative than individual brain writing. How do you put those? They seem to contradict each other, those two points.
Yes. Yeah. And one thing I really had to grapple with in the chapter on thinking with groups is the fact that almost everyone I know hates working in a group. There's even this phenomenon. It's been named by researchers group hate, like this feeling of loathing and dread that so many of us bring to group work. And I really had to wrestle with why that is. I mean, I share that feeling. I do a lot of work on my own. And yet it is hard to reconcile that at first with the fact that we, again, humans evolved to think together, to operate in groups, to collaborate. And so why is it so difficult and why is it often so unsatisfactory or ineffective? And I came to think that in our very individualistic culture, we have habits and practices of thinking that are suited to individual thinking, but then really don't work for us and are really very maladaptive when we bring them into a group setting. So for example, when you're just thinking to yourself, you don't need to always be sort of signposting what you're thinking because you know what you're thinking. But in a group, it's incredibly important that you make your own thought processes visible to other people. And we don't really have practices or protocols for doing that. And to give another example, we know what we know, you know, consciously anyway, we have access to all of our own knowledge. But in a group, it's often the case that members of the group will have information that could be really valuable to the problem solving that the group is engaged in, but they don't share it. They end up just sharing the information that everybody already knows. So again, we need to have practices and protocols for eliciting all the information that's all the useful information that's being held in the minds of the various people in the group. So I think we just really need to learn and implement more structured forms of communication if we want to think well together.
That's such a good point. I'm fascinated by this first one, actually, that we need to explain our thought processes. Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorite ways of helping groups do that? Because whether I'm teaching students in a classroom or working with leadership teams or sports teams, I often find that people talk past each other and they run into relationship conflicts because they haven't unpacked the reasoning behind their opinions or their conclusions. What do you do about that?
Yes, I'm thinking of this research on radically co-located teams, this research that suggests that the very most effective way for teams to work together is for that to put them all in one room together and have them work together for, you know, even days at a time and to have artifacts created by the group that are stable. In other words, it's not like a room that gets all the papers and signs get taken down every time they leave their conference. All those artifacts stay up and are visible to the people who are collaborating together for this very intense period. And what happens over time is that people, you know, when you externalize your the information in your head, when you cognitively offload that information onto a large, revisable, you know, persistent artifact. And I'm thinking really of like one of those giant pads of paper. And that, so it doesn't have to be anything fancy. We're talking about a really analog kind of technology here. But and then when those pieces of paper get hung around the room, people start gesturing at the pieces of paper it becomes like almost like an externalized brain that everyone is sharing. And so, you know, there's a big debate now, obviously, about bringing people back into the office and should we allow people to continue to work remotely? And, you know, that's going to play out over years, I'm sure. But I have a real bias in favor of people being in a room together, at least some of the time. I think the signals that we exchange with each other, a lot of that richness is lost when we are communicating online. And so I'm intrigued by this idea that maybe what we need to do to get the best out of our teams is to throw them in a room together, externalize their thoughts onto these visible artifacts, and maybe make them stay in there for like a few days at a time.
Well, I'm not sure
anybody's volunteering for that, but
no, that's actually my dream model of collaboration. Yeah. But what I love about it is that it actually doesn't require us to be in the office, right? That might be 3 days a month doing a deep dive together as a team, or what my mentor Jane Dutton used to call a blitz session. She would work on papers by flying her co-authors in from all around the world. They would stay at her house and they would basically work for 2, 3, 5 days. And then they'd figure out they've solved everything they need to do together, and they divide and conquer in separate places for the more individual parts of the work. I thought that made so much sense, in part because it activates what Anita Woolley and her colleagues have called burstiness, which is that ability to, you know, to have ideas and thoughts flying back and forth, rapid fire in real time. And I was so intrigued that part of the reason burstiness is good for both productivity and creativity, this is, you know, not just in face-to-face groups, but in virtual groups too, is not just the ability to build on each other. It's the fact that it's motivating to know that somebody is there with you, ready to respond in real time, as opposed to, I'm going to send something out into the ether or over this glitchy platform that we're using and hope that you engage.
Right. And that model that you just described also facilitates this idea that I write about in the book of intermittent collaboration, that meeting in that intense way all the time would not be good either, that there's an oscillation ideally that happens between that kind of intense collaboration and then time by yourself or time away from the social pressures of the group that allows you to think your own thoughts. So I think we need to give some real thought to how we can build spaces that support burstiness and support intermittent collaboration. I think this is actually a great moment of reinvention and opportunity to think about that.
Bring it on. So Annie, you make a big point in pulling all of these insights together about the extended mind, that if you're not extending your mind by engaging your body, the physical space around you, and your social interactions, you're actually making yourself dumber.
Yes. And I further suggest that we've kind of reached the limits of the biological brain. We've created a world that is so complex, that's so full of information, where expertise is so specialized, that the biological brain has really met its limit, and that the only way right now to become more intelligent is to augment the limited capacity of the biological brain with these mental extensions.
That makes me wonder, of course, about neural enhancement. When I think about, you know, different kinds of brain augmentation technologies that are in very early stage development, I wonder if they're going to be substitutes for the extended mind, or is there a risk that they're going to be designed only to amplify cognitive capabilities and miss out on some of the kinds of extensions that you've been describing?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think we've already seen that happen with artificial intelligence. I mean, there's been amazing leaps ahead with the artificial intelligence in terms of computers that can play chess or go and beat any human. But then in other ways, artificial intelligence has been so disappointing. And I think that's because the pioneers of artificial intelligence had this very brain-bound model of how intelligence works. They often didn't include an embodied substrate, you know, that, and so much of our human intelligence emerges from the body. So the kinds of very limited and brittle and inflexible intelligence that we see in computers and robots may be a function of the fact that we've engineered out all the messy parts of humanity, you know, but it turns out that those messy parts are responsible for a lot of our how smart we are.
I like the thought of that. I think we could use a little more mental messiness in the world. Yeah. And also a little less too. And I don't know how to get the good without the bad, but maybe that will be tackled in a future Annie Murphy Paul book.
Maybe.
Speaking of which, I want to ask you about science writing. Mm. I do not think there is a clearer or more insightful science writer on the planet than you. I've admired your writing since the day I first came across it. And I would love to hear a little bit about how you go about synthesizing evidence and how you take what are often very complex and sometimes confusing studies and make them understandable.
Yeah. Well, I'll take the second part of your question first about making studies, difficult or complex studies, accessible. I really see that as an act of empathy. And it's akin to teaching when you're teaching and you need to imagine yourself into the mind of your student and what they're understanding and what they're not. The benefit of teaching is that you have so many cues flowing back from the student about they're getting it, they're not getting it. You can see by the look on their face or they can ask questions. When you're writing, all of that empathy for the reader has to be sort of imaginative. You have to be putting yourself in the shoes of the reader and imagining, are they getting this? Are they with me? Am I taking them along or did they get lost at some point? And trying to imagine what questions are arising in their minds as they're reading and anticipating and answering those questions before they can get confused or lost. And so to me, it's, you know, even though I do spend most of my days alone as a freelancer, in a way, I've got this conversation going on in my head with the reader all the time. So I'm not really alone at all. But then that question also about synthesizing, I really see that as something that may remain the province of the science writer for a while. I mean, I see more and more academics like yourself writing and doing an amazing job of it. But I do like the idea of the science writer as someone who's a bit outside a discipline and who's not trained so deeply and so narrowly as many scientists are, and who can sort of range across many different areas of research. That's what I enjoy most about what I do. I like being a magpie, to kind of to borrow a metaphor of my own, which I use to describe the mind. But I like the idea of gathering things from here and there and weaving them together into something new.
It certainly shows. One thing I've noticed when looking at how people communicate ideas is I know a decent number of great talkers who are terrible writers. But the reverse is very rare. Almost every great writer I know is an excellent speaker.
Interesting.
Agree or disagree? And what do you make of that?
I have always thought that I became a writer because I'm much better in print than I am verbally. You know, I like to take the time to very carefully consider my word choice. And when you're talking, you just sort of have to wing it. And I think I'm more comfortable with that now. And certainly with the extended mind, I spent so many years immersed in this research that I could talk about it in my sleep at this point, you know, but they're related, but different, you know. I mean, I do appreciate the differences between a conversation and a written form. And I think that's when I teach, that's actually something I really need to emphasize to my students, that reading on the page is a different experience from hearing words spoken into the air. And the two different genres are interestingly distinct.
Do you think then that, I guess part of what I was wondering is, a lot of times people get away with unclear or maybe muddled thoughts because they speak enthusiastically or they show mm-hmm. confidence or mm-hmm. they exude charisma. Mm-hmm. And in writing, it's much harder to do that. Mm-hmm. You're being mm-hmm. evaluated much more directly on the clarity and, you know, the quality of your reasoning.
Yes.
And I've wondered then if the act of writing something down is a form of extending the mind that then improves your ability to communicate it through other media, whereas the reverse is not true, that saying something many different ways or many different times doesn't necessarily sharpen the clarity of it.
Interesting. I would really say that that goes both ways, because I do appreciate the way in which writing something down offers you what I write about in the book as this detachment gain, this idea that you're putting space between yourself and your ideas. And then when it's on the page, you can look at it and interact with it in a different way. I definitely find that to be true. But I also sometimes find that my ideas come out in a conversation with a friend in a way that I can then feed back into my writing, maybe because there is that insistent pressure during a conversation to just come out with something, you know, whereas with writing, you can take as long as you want, but with talking, you just have to keep going. And sometimes that forces something out into the open that maybe you weren't thinking of before.
As the psychologist Jamie Pennebaker put it, many of us find that communicating our thoughts is a supremely enjoyable learning experience. I guess there's something to that.
People do love to hear themselves talk, that's for sure.
I would much rather learn from someone else's thoughts than my own. But Annie, is there anything else that you want to surface that I didn't ask you about?
Yeah, one thing that's really important to me about the extended mind that I really only touched on in the book, but is something I've continued to think about, is this idea of what I call in the book extension inequality. You know, once you start realizing, at least this is what happened for me, is once I started realizing how crucial mental extensions are to intelligent thought, I couldn't help but then notice and become, you know, distressed about the fact that these mental extensions are in no way equitably distributed. And yet our culture continues to evaluate and rank people according to supposedly, you know, the quantity of stuff that's in here. So to me, you know, that's what the last line of the book was about, that if we can start to understand that so much of what we are is what's around us, you know, is the culture and the environment that we're embedded in, then maybe we can have a little more patience and generosity with each other, that it's not all internal or innate. We're so much the creatures of the world that we inhabit.
Well, I guess that raises one other question for me, which is, I have a vague memory that this book was supposed to come out several years earlier.
Yeah. And you are correct. You are correct.
Okay, so I'm not totally wrong in that. I think the last time I saw you, you were pretty close to done with a draft of a book that I thought was going to be about maybe something narrower, which was about, mm-hmm. I think it was about group mind, essentially. And I wonder what happened. Did you expand your idea of what the book was going to be and realize that you're actually tackling a much bigger question than you set out to explore?
Something like that happened. Yeah, it was actually going to be, it was much more rooted. The original conception of this book was much more rooted in the science of learning. And the reason that book never came out is that I never found that big idea that could pull together the findings from the science of learning that I found so interesting. And I arrived at my own theory of why that was. And I'm interested to see what you think, Adam, because you know a lot about learning and cognition, that there is no grand unifying theory of learning, because the brain is this kludgy, patched together product of evolution, that really the only organizing principle is what helped us to survive. And so there's all these tricks that we've learned to kind of to make our brains do what we want them to do, but there's no organizing principle or design, because there was no designer.
Oh, that's interesting. And why do you think the extended mind is different then?
Because the extended mind sort of starts from the place of understanding that our brains evolved to survive and to thrive in bodies, in settings, among people, you know, to look at the brain as an isolated organ, a kind of brain in a vat, was always just a really misguided way of looking at thinking and how thinking works. And I think that's actually what I came up against repeatedly and why I eventually had to take a different tack.
I think that makes sense. And so I guess one of the challenges of writing a book about the science of learning is we don't have even an alternative theory, right, to challenge, right, or to complicate. I wonder, though, if you could break it up into subtopics. So, for example, when I think about the motivations to learn, I think about surprise, curiosity, confusion, humility, right? I could think about a bunch of emotions or mental states that you could activate that we know increase the desire to learn something new or allow people to recognize that they have something to learn. And then I think a different branch of learning science is about memory. And how do you think about storing and retrieving information? And there, too, we run into the same challenge you tackled in this book, which is, well, our brains actually don't work like computers, even though we think they do. And maybe it's just too grand to expect that all of those different functions of the brain come together under the guise of learning. But maybe there are other ways to look at the different elements of learning that I guess have what Carl Weick would call middle range theories associated with them.
Maybe my problem is I'm not satisfied with middle range theories. I like the big, you know, go for broke theory. And so I had to find something big enough to keep me interested to, you know, to get through the slog of writing a book.
But that's what's so powerful about this book is it's bursting with new ideas and really, in some ways, you know, mind-altering data. And yet it all fits together around this core realization that thinking happens outside of your head.
Right, right. So better late than never, right?
I'm glad you didn't release the earlier book because I think this is so much more exciting and novel. And one of the biggest gifts that you've given us with this book, Annie, is you have extended our minds, right, by showing us how to extend our own minds.
Well, thank you, Adam. Thanks. You know, I always think of Sturgeon's Law. Do you know this? 90% of everything is shit. And I was like, I don't want to add to all the books in the world unless it's like something actually new and original and fresh. So I hope I did that. Even though it's not even my idea, you know, it's ironic because I borrowed somebody else's idea to do it. But
I think most great ideas are borrowed. But you did remind me of a story that the great Dan Wegner used to tell about how half a century ago, the field of psychology was a bunch of men standing in piles of shit with signs that say, look at me. And he said, you know, psychology's made a lot of progress in half a century. We now have women doing this too.
Oh, I never met him, but I've heard he was incredibly funny and witty and humane.
So clever and smart and kind. Yeah, big loss for the field. But his work on transactive memory is immortalized in your writing, which I thought was amazing.
Yes, yeah. And I love that story that I tell about he got the idea for transactive memory when he and his wife got married. And almost immediately when they started living together, they started unconsciously dividing tasks in the household. And he realized that something was going on here, that they were expanding their access to knowledge and expertise by sort of knowing, by just dividing between them, which person would do which tasks and that the same thing could happen in a team.
Yeah. And that when a team breaks up or a relationship ends, then the loss is not just the person or the group, right? It's you've literally lost part of your knowledge and people took it with them. You're like, wait, I don't know how to pay the bills. Like, where do I start?
Right. You took part of my mind with you. Yes. Yeah.
How dare you? What a jerk.
Yeah. I think that speaks to how profound this idea is. You know, I just was speaking to a doctor, Jason Karlowish, who's at Penn, and he works with Alzheimer's patients. And we were talking about how caregivers function as the extended minds of Alzheimer's patients. And so that introduces all these moral issues of like, should Alzheimer's patients be allowed to see their caregivers even in the time of COVID? And is it ethical to move them out of their homes, which in a way also function as parts of their extended mind? Like, once you start thinking about the extended mind, there's just so many implications and applications of it.
Well, that is a mark of a truly great book, right? It raises as many new questions as it answers. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate that.
Oh, this was so fun and fascinating. I could listen to you talk all day.
Would you like to hear what Annie thinks are the five biggest ideas from the Extended Mind? Download the Next Big Idea app and check out her book bite. And don't stop there. In our app, you'll also find 12-minute audio summaries of other brilliant new books, Zoom discussions between Adam and a bunch of other great authors, and mind-extending e-courses. Search for the Next Big Idea in your app store. If you like this show, leave us a review and a 5-star rating if you think we've earned it. Thank you, Adam Grant and Annie Murphy-Paul. Our executive producers are Caleb Bissinger and Michael Kovnat. Theme music by Costa Galanopoulos. Sound design by Mike Toda. I'm your host, Rufus Griscom. See you next week.